we've recorded some silence. We've all got our recording apparatus turned on. I have prevented the dog from barking with a juicy bone. So it must be time to start
The Next Voice podcast, series 4, episode 9. I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Ben Everard.
I am Graham Morrison.
And I'm Mike Saunders.
And in this, quite frankly, awesome podcast still to go, we've got news, we've got the halfway reminder, we've got Finds of the Fortnight, we've got the voice of the masses, we've got the vocalise your neurons thing, we've got just so much stuff, so sit back and get ready for the roller coaster ride. If you like the sound of that sort of thing, but flat rather than on sound waves, you can subscribe to the magazine at shop.linuxvoice.com. And that means that's paper, and it's electrons, it's PDFs and EPUBs, and there's no DRM in any of it. Right, let's go. News time.
Okay, and on with news. The first news story this fortnight is that Android apps are coming to Chrome OS. This is the second bit of news, actually, of Chrome OS as well. It's now the second biggest selling operating system on laptops after Windows, knocking out macOS. So this is obviously Google's version of Linux, or one of Google's versions of Linux, and it's becoming quite popular.
Well done, Google.
Yes, well done, Google.
Plucky little Google.
Sticking it to the man. Guys. Yeah, sticking it to the man.
previously Chrome OS has been basically entirely built around the Chrome browser, as you may guess from the name. And now if you've got one of these Chrome OS devices, over the next few months, you may see a Google Play icon appear that will allow you to install applications. It'll be more or less all the applications. The only exceptions will be ones that require specific home phone hardware, GPSs and whatnot. And you can install them, so they'll run offline. You can they'll sit in Windows rather than taking the full screen as they would in Android.
Yeah.
And they'll run inside Linux containers.
This is good.
Yeah, I mean it's always good to see more software coming to Linux devices. Although obviously almost all the software in the Google Play Store isn't open source.
Yeah.
But it may well open the door for things like F-Droid to work.
And will it make it easier to run Android apps on a regular Linux desktop? Because I imagine the Chrome OS component could be open source or at least reverse engineerable.
Yeah, in theory, it should, because if you can run it on Chrome OS, you should be able to run it on a regular Linux distro. In practice, a lot will depend on the various secret sources that Google pour into it and how secret those sources are. As far as I'm aware, there's no technical thing stopping it.
I must admit, I don't have... here we go. I must admit, I don't have much experience of Chromebooks myself. I mean, there's the big issue about, you know, Google being a massive data swallowing company. They certainly seem like quite reliable devices for many people who don't want to have to deal with operating system reinstalls, and you just, you know, turn it on and use it, and it sorts itself out. They're quite hard to break, so I hear.
Yeah, I've been using one for the last 18 months or so, and it's not my PC. It's not what I do most of my work on, but it's fantastic to have a device you just don't have to think about. You don't have to install this or update that or anything. It just does it. It gets the updates it needs when it turns on, but it doesn't force them down your throat like some things do, and it just works. But you've got to be aware of the limitations in the, you know, so
it is. You're running just normal Chrome OS on it?
Yeah, I have run some of the other Chroot Linuxes. I actually can't remember which ones now. At the moment I'm just running Chrome OS, and that does what I need. As I say, it's not my main computer. It sort of sits somewhere between a tablet and a computer. It's a bit more useful than a tablet, a bit less useful than a PC.
I seem to recall recently that Google said in a blog post that Chrome OS has a future. Chrome OS will live on, where everybody's talking about the potential merger of Android and Chrome OS one day. How do you think this affects that?
So do you mean merging Chrome OS and Android?
Yeah, what did I just say?
I'm not sure, you were breaking up a little bit.
Okay, so yeah, Chrome OS and Android. Do you think they will merge one day?
Honestly, I don't think they will, because I think they fill different niches. I wouldn't want an Android laptop. I am quite happy with my Chrome OS device, and at the same time, I wouldn't want Chrome OS on my phone. And I think it's a good split between them. I think it makes sense, even though it's a little bit difficult to articulate exactly what it is. Yeah, I mean, maybe you could get into the sort of situation a little bit like the Ubuntu thing, where it's an Android thing until you plug in a keyboard and it becomes Chrome OS or something, I don't know. But unless there's some fairly major redesigns to either of them, I think it still makes sense to have two separate OSs.
Fair enough.
Maybe as an aside to this story, we should mention that Google's Paris offices were raided by the French police today, which is the Tuesday evening we're recording this, by magistrates investigating tax payments and investigating aggravated financial fraud and organised money laundering.
Yeah, I mean, this is I don't know. I like to think it's fantastic news, but yeah. I guess that really is very subjective. You can sort of really see the contrasting ways that the British and French tax authorities have dealt with Google on this. Yeah. And we sort of accepted whatever loose pocket change they threw out the window and went away.
Well, we did as the public, but I suspect that the people who actually made the negotiations got more out of it than that.
Yeah.
Kudos and friends at Google. Isn't that the way that it works? I'm sorry. I mean, at least the French have had a revolution to get rid of this sort of thing.
So they went in, battered down the doors, and took out. They left like €1 billion in tax revenue. I think it's more than €1 billion.
Sorry.
Certain searches that you may conduct on certain members of the royal family just won't return any results.
Right, should we move on to our next news story?
Yes, quickly.
And that is Critter. They've launched a crowdfunding campaign to try and get more features into there, or fund more features developing, specifically text and... I can't even read my own handwriting here.
Handwriting? In this day and age? Yeah. Not doing everything on a computer, not doing everything on your Chromebook.
No. Oh, here we go. And better vector tools. So they're going to shift from the ODG to the SVG file format for their sort of core files. And there's various stretch goals and that sort of thing. They're after €30,000, so about 0.1% of the amount of tax Google owes in France. I can't do maths in my head. I've no idea what percentage is.
I suspect smaller than that.
Just before we recorded, they were up to €22,877 with 14 days left to go. So they're well on their way. It's a fantastic application. It's not one I use a lot because I am completely inept artistically, but it's one that I like when I do use it.
That's interesting. Interesting that they're moving from ODG to SVG. I mean, both are proper, like, ratified standards, but I guess they just think, well, everything can import SVG, so they just want to go for a file format that's so ubiquitous.
Yeah, well, what they say in their Kickstarter page is that if you sort of think of the features within them, the ODG was designed to be an Office Suite file format, really, and it's got the features that Office Suites want. Whereas SVG is an art file format. It's got the features that art wants. And although they are interoperable to a certain amount or sort of have broadly similar things, they make different things easy. And SVG makes more sense for an artist's tool.
This is something that the Critter Project keeps doing, isn't it? They keep having these successful, I must say, crowdfunding campaigns. And I must say, it's like one of the best examples. It's a wonderful project. It's like, I can't believe we still talk about the GIMP when Critter has had like CMYK support for so long. But this seems to me a really viable way of keeping projects alive and you know, really active and getting stuff into a project that you really want to see. You know, we mentioned it with Qt Browser a couple of episodes ago where he needed some money to port the web engine to a new web engine. And I really like this kind of way of contributing to an open source project.
Yeah, it's really come along at the right time, hasn't it? The crowdfunding, Kickstarter, Indiegogo. I mean, we did it ourselves, didn't we? That people feel like they're part of something. People who don't like the old model of just sending money to buy a box set of software. Yeah. They can donate what they want. You know, thinking about how much they get out of the software. And yeah, I was just going to ask the same thing. I'm having deja vu here. Didn't Critter already do this?
Yeah. But
you said they've already done it a few times.
Yeah, they have.
They do it every year.
Oh, God. So sort of it's been a year.
Oh, man. Which, yeah, it's quite a sensible way of doing things, but I think. I think it really is a good way of bringing people into the project as well. It's not just saying, give us money. It's saying, we want some money. This is what we want to do with it. If you support us, we'll do these things.
Cool. Yeah, good luck. Awesome.
Right. Let's move on to the third item of news this week. This is the Google versus Oracle court case. This is the it feels like this is a never-ending court case. This is like SCO version 2. It just won't die. I have to turn my pad of notes over for this. I'll give you a very brief history of what's gone on so far. So, as you probably know, Google use a version of Java in Android, and this particular version comes from Apache Harmony, not from any of the Sun versions or the Sun open source versions, but it's an entirely separate implementation. So Oracle in 2012, shortly after they'd bought Sun, filed a copyright claim over some code they claimed had been stolen, some patents they claimed had been infringed, and a copyright over the API of Java. And this went to court in 2012. The patents were thrown out as not being infringed. The code, the code was deemed to be infringing, but it was so little that they awarded $0 in damages. And about the copyright of the API, the judge ruled that, and I quote, "So long as the specific code used to implement a method is different, anyone is free under the Copyright Act to write his or her own code to carry out exactly the same function or specification of any of the methods used in the Java API. It does not matter that the declaration or methods are identical." Which seems to me to be exactly the right ruling. That's what you'd want. I don't know anything about American law, but that's what I would want it to say. However, this went to appeal, and in 2014, a judge ruled that the structure, sequence, and organization of an API is copyrightable. So, and then they wanted to go to the Supreme Court to sort of test all this out, and that was rejected, and it's gone back to the district court. So at this point, basically, they've had to accept that APIs are copyrighted, but under copyright, you're allowed what's called fair use. This is situations which you can use someone else's copyright material in a way that's reasonable and they can't object to. So this whole court case is decide whether or not re-implementing APIs is considered fair use, even if the APIs are copyrighted. Various sides have put their cases forward. Just before we've recorded this, the final closing statements have been put in, and the jury are scratching their heads and deciding what to do. We should point out that this only affects past versions of Android, as future ones will use the OpenJDK, which was released by Sun and therefore is licensed, even though it's open source, just as Apache Harmony is.
I was just going to say that after talking about all the awesomeness of Critter and crowdfunding and people getting involved and supporting the open source projects, this is pretty much the exact opposite, isn't it? Courtroom squabbles and money grabbing. And
yeah, I mean, Oracle are seeking, it's almost $9 billion, which presumably Google can't afford to pay because they need it for their French tax bill. but this has huge far-reaching implications, because if APIs are deemed to be copyrightable and, what's the word, non-re-implementable, I guess, then that means everything. I mean, that means Linux is impinging on Unix's API. It means everyone who, you know, it's everywhere. You re-implement APIs all the time. It's just how coding works sometimes.
I'll even have to close down the MicOS project, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, what does that mean? And what about Oracle's version of SQL? Is that infringing
maybe copyright? Carpenters who make like dovetail joints will have to stop making their furniture and joints fit with other little bits of furniture with the same joint.
Yeah. What about libraries and using titles and stuff indexing
and systems? And in fact, any kind of protocol, I suppose, must fall into the same category. Or maybe language itself. Maybe what we should do is all of us speak a random stream of noises. If we,
that's what I do
if
anyway.
If we mistakenly understand one another, we have to pay the copyright fee.
Yeah.
There's a good sci-fi book in here somewhere.
There's an excellent take on this in the Vice website. It's headed, "In Oracle versus Google, a nerd subculture is on trial." And the second paragraph reads, "In a world where Silicon Valley is coming into dominance, Oracle versus Google is an unusual instance in which the nerds are getting totally owned by the normals." Right, my comment, normals? What, judges and lawyers? That's odd. "Their judgments on the technologies they have birthed is being overridden by old people in black robes. Their beloved traditions and mythologies around free and open source software are being scoffed at by corporate stiffs in suits as inconsistent hippie nonsense." And it continues in that vein. It's very, well, I get angry when people use the word interesting, but I found it, it interested me.
Shall we end this news story on something that's at least a little bit lighthearted?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that's...
Yes.
In a deposition, there's a witness on the stand explaining a little bit about the history of free software. And in this, the phrase GNU came up, and the judge wanted to know what GNU was. And I quote, "The G part stands for GNU?" Judge Allsop asked. "Yes," said George on the stand. "That doesn't make any sense." And it's kind of hard to argue with that.
Yeah, I take it all back.
Yeah, it's a bit like when Richard Stallman's giving a good passionate speech about free software, but then starts talking about the four freedoms from Freedom Zero. Like, okay, a nice in-joke for us C programmers, but the rest of the world just thinks, what is this guy on?
Right, let's move on to our final news story this fortnight, and this is that Firefox Test Pilot has launched. This is a new version of Firefox that allows you to turn on and off experimental features so you can try out the latest gubbinses without having to run all the unstable stuff at once and having it just fall apart horribly. So on the current Firefox Test Pilot, you can activate Activity Stream, which as far as I can gather is basically just a fancy history. There's a tab sensor. You can have your tabs vertically rather than horizontally if you like. And there's a sort of Chrome-style universal search address bar in one jobby thing. They're going to use the data from people in Test Pilot to decide what features they should put more effort into and which to develop in the future.
I thought the combined address bar and search bar was already a thing. I use Firefox and I just type my random nonsense into the address bar and it searches for it.
Yeah, but there's also the search bar on the end.
Yeah.
Oh, I see, which I've never used, yeah.
Well, I just drag it out of there in the customised mode so that I don't have to see it.
Yeah. I just have to offend my eyes.
Yeah. Okay, well, good luck, Firefox.
Yeah, carry on.
And that's the news this fortnight.
Excellent. Brilliant news. Thanks, Ben. So it's now time for Finds of the Fortnight. Now, we're recording this quite late on a Tuesday evening, and so I did ask the IRC channel if anybody had any finds just as we started recording. And the sound that you kept hearing in the background was the sound of my phone pinging whenever somebody mentioned my name on IRC. So... We do actually have a few. I open the first couple up in a web browser. Just let me get to...
Do you reckon in the next podcast recording, people in the IRC cat channel are going to just start typing your name to try and play a tune?
I'm using the WeChat client on Android, and I did try to turn the volume down while we were talking, but it actually reduces the size of the font in WeChat. there's quite a few. Oh, sorry, give me a second. I've just got to find out the point where I asked it. Okay, so the first one we have is from Ioan Gogo, who says... he stole this from LAS and used it and has a lot of detail in it. And that's github.com/firehole/netdata. So netdata v1.2.0, it's a real-time Linux monitoring tool. Okay, after that, we've got Nuntuis. What's that in a browser? This isn't working too... okay, this delivers notifications from your phone or tablet to your computer over Bluetooth. Oh, that's a pretty good discovery. I like doing things like that. I use one of those tools that uses the an API to send notifications to my phone from things like the alarm system. Mukfail, avant/.org is a Perl CGI script which you run on your server to give you a non-horrible /.dot reading experience. I wonder if he means it gets rid of all the comments. empty the Void says, we all talked about it in 2004, but he's discovered ZNC and it's great. ZNC is an IRC bouncer. I know this because I use it myself. It may have been me that mentioned it. It's absolutely brilliant. The more and more you start to rely on IRC, you don't want to miss conversations, and ZNC allows you to connect multiple clients to the same session and also buffer and restore your sessions. It turns IRC into like a communications tool for the 21st century rather than something from the 19th century. See if there's anything. There's been a long conversation actually, and I don't want to have to go through it all. Oh, this was a good one. Mukfail says, second find, Vim has persistent undo across sessions. Ask it for help on undo file. I didn't know that. Did you know that, Mike?
No, nor did I. And I'm a big Vim fan. I converted about 18 months ago, I think. Now it always amazes me what Vim can do. People spend years learning it, so that's
your
awesome.
Video is brilliant. I mean, I've noticed that it's gone up to like 40,000 or 50,000 views now. It may even be more.
That the introduction one I did if anybody's, I guess we could put a link in the podcast notes. But if anybody's not convinced by Vim, just YouTube for Linux Voice introduction to Vim, and I think it should be there.
Yeah, it's a really good introduction.
Word processor has persistent undo as well, and it's something that has cropped up a lot of politicians. They put out press releases with Word files, and you can just press undo and see what they really think.
See the magic as it unfolds.
But I assume Vim doesn't store it in the text file.
No, that would be just silly, wouldn't it? And the last one, the last one's from Ian Gogo, Ioan Gogo. Oh, Pulse Audio Networking Support is brilliant, he says. I've not tried it recently, but he says it's especially good with those new laptops with hybrid headphone ports. I think I know what he means. So they're the finds from IRC.
Awesome.
Yeah, thanks very much. I'll move on. Kind of to my phone, because somebody, Mavericks, actually messaged me earlier on today, not to say that I'm not sure if this qualifies as a find, as it may be fairly old news and it's not primarily Linux related, but apparently there are other magazines that also make their content for free online. In particular, he's found that all the back issues of Popular Mechanics are available for reading and searching all the way back to the early 1900s. Cool. Popular Mechanics is an awesome thing if you're into, you know, DIY hardware, PCBs and electronics and all that stuff. So that's an excellent find.
There's also a load of magazines on archive.org, particularly, as I recall, sort of 80s-style computing magazines, well, actual 80s computing magazines. So quite good for reminiscing if they're not the most current things in the world. Yeah, and they've got all sorts of old electronic stuff on there and that sort of thing.
Oh, well, that actually leads me to my second find, which is actually a game called Lumo. I think the embargo on Lumo may be lifted today. I've certainly seen a couple of reviews today. This is by a small development studio headed up by a guy called Gareth Noyce, who says lots of lovely things about Linux Voice. And in particular, I think, because we're somewhat similar, at least in attitude, to those computer magazines in the 80s. And his game, Lumo, is an isometric puzzle game, massively inspired by all of the isometric puzzle games that used to get developed by British bedroom programmers back in the 80s. And it's really, really good. I've played it. I don't want to spoil it too much, but if you remember all those Ultimate Play the Game games, or Head Over Heels, or a game I never finished, actually, which is called Chimera. But it had a Chimera, incidentally, had amazing music. It was like on the Mastertronic budget label. This is a game that does all of the same things, drops lots and lots of references to those 80s magazines and computer magazines, as well as modern references. In fact, Gareth on our IRC channel today was just saying how so many people had given him access to their IP, including Liz Upton, the Raspberry Pi Foundation, because he's thrown everything in there to turn it into a kind of an arc of the British games industry, you know, entombed, to choose an ultimate game, inside an 80s kind of game engine and aesthetic. Although the graphics are amazing, they're modern. You get it on Linux, you get it on the PlayStation 4 and PC, and really, I would highly recommend it.
That is so awesome. To see some of those sort of old game genres being brought back to life. Retro gaming seems to be actually really popular at the moment. I was in my local newsagent recently here in Munich, and I saw three separate retro gaming magazines. That's something I thought would never happen.
Yeah, and I think it's more than just nostalgia. I think there's more, you know, like, for example, the Japanese RPGs have never gone out of fashion, and it's because there's no other way of actually playing those kind of games. There's something to the mechanic and the way they function, like old text adventure games and like those isometric games, that makes you focus rather than get lost in a big open world GTA 5s, which are great in their own right.
Yeah, yeah. And also, at least from my perspective, I like reading about games now that I used to play, and reading about their development process, because when I was 8 or 10 or 14, I didn't really know. I was doing a bit of like basic programming, but when I read now about assembly hackers doing stuff on the Game Boy, spending seemingly 72 hours a day hacking code, it's amazing. But we're getting a bit off topic.
It's actually interesting you mention that, because there was a chat on the Linux Voice channel today with Gareth Noyce, who's Corruptor on Freenode. And I said to him, it would be really cool to read like a diary of the things that have gone into Lumo, in the same way that, and I've mentioned it before on here, but Andrew Braybrook's diary in Zap 64 of how he created Paradroid, and he mentioned one from the Spectrum in Crash, and there's been a few others. There was Jeff Minter's one of his Llamatron games, and he said that when he gets the time, he'll do it. So it would be great to read about the making of Lumo and all the things that have gone into it, and maybe some of his past history as well. Yeah. I do have a few finds, I suppose, but I don't want to go on too long. I've started using WeChat in earnest after writing about it a couple of years ago. And the best plugin I found for it is called RISSI Notifier. It's basically a port of the RSSI plugin that sends notifications to your Android phone, which is why my phone keeps beeping when somebody mentions my name. The other thing that I didn't realise was that Tmux has a plugin system. And so I've been playing with loads of Tmux plugins. My favourite is in Fospix, in the issue that we've just sent to the printers, which you press a hotkey and all of the pasteable passwords and URLs in the screen become copyable from a single key shortcut. Another one, Yanks copy and paste out of the session, and another one saves and restores TMUX sessions and even opens a Vim file to the same line you're editing. So I'll put the links in the podcast notes and give them a go. They're my finds.
That's brilliant. Yeah, TMUX, for those who don't know, is the terminal multiplex. So it's basically a window manager for your terminal. So if you're SSH'd into a remote server and you've got a nice big terminal open, run TMUX, you can organize different panels side by side. You can also disconnect and reconnect to the session. So yeah, if you log out of the server, you don't have to log back in and then restart all your programs. I do this all the time. I have a Raspberry Pi doing all sorts of work as backup store and IRC clients, and I can just log onto it from any of my computers here in this admittedly small flat. But yeah, I've spent ages messing around with TMUX, and I had no idea it had a plugin system until now. So
yeah, and it works really well. Once you've enabled it, because you can edit the TMUX configuration file on the fly within TMUX, and you just add GitHub URLs into the plugin file and click on reload, and then they become available and active straight away. The save and resume session one is brilliant because you can be doing something and you just press the shortcut for saving the session and you can restore it at any point. It doesn't even matter if you've detached and then reattached. It'll recreate the environment.
That's brilliant. The more I use TMUX, the more I just want to switch my whole workflow to text mode applications. And then it gets a bit sort of crazy. I'm trying to use W3M to browse the web and I'm like, okay,
yeah,
some things deserve graphics. But my find was sent to me from Matthew Withers, who said, I recently discovered a very nifty tool called Synergy. It allows you to share one mouse or keyboard input across several different machines at once, like you would have with multiple monitors from one machine. Works across Windows, OS X, and Linux at once. This is great for me at work as I use one university machine and my own laptop and live with two keyboards and two mice, and now I only need one. It does this with some clever non-video KVM trickery. But he says, the tool is GPL v2, so free software license, but the developers have built in a one-time lifetime registration payment system. I'm more than happy to pay for this open source. I think the model works well. You can always compile from source if you do not wish to pay. I love the magazine and podcasts. Keep up the great work. Thanks, Matthew. I have seen this model used for some other open source free software projects as well, where I think it might have been XChat IRC client on the Windows or OS X versions. The code was GPL, but you had to pay for the binaries. And I thought, well, you know, as long as the code ultimately is open source free software, then, but the developers are still making some money, then fair enough.
Arda does that.
Yeah.
Yeah, he does exactly the same thing. If you want to download the Windows or OS X binaries, or in fact the Linux binaries from his site, then you have to pay a subscription or a one-off fee.
Okay, I guess the difference with Linux is that everybody pretty much gets the software from the distributions repository, so nobody really goes to a site and downloads Linux binaries.
Yeah.
Maybe occasionally for Firefox and LibreOffice and big apps, but yeah.
I must say it's a bit annoying because a few times I've wanted to test out the OS X version of Arda, and in fact I've paid him money for one of the versions that I got, but it was just a beta version. I didn't pay for the subscription model, and it times out after 10 minutes if you just want the demo. So, yeah.
Oh, well. Anyway, that's my... Oh, and CC Mixer, or CC Mixter, I forget. That's my other find, a great resource for Creative Commons music. I did know of it before, but I've been going through it recently for making some videos, and it's just fantastic.
Oh, cool. Ben?
Yes, I've got a few finds this fortnight. I'll go for the first one that's completely not Linux or technology related in any way, but I found it quite interesting. There's five different uses of the word bull or bully in English, and they all have different origins. So there's bull, which is the cow, which comes from the Old English bull, meaning male cow. There's... Obviously. There's to talk bull, which I always thought was just a more polite version of to talk bull excrement.
I thought but so too.
Yeah.
It's not at all. That's sort of, I don't know what the sort of backronym type word for it is, but that's been created afterwards. It comes from the French boule, the old French boule, which means deception. And I probably mispronounced that.
Oh.
And then there's bully, which comes from Middle Dutch, meaning lover, oddly enough.
Huh.
Well, smash the patriarchy. See the violence inherent in the system.
Yeah. There's also bully beef, which comes from the French brûler, to boil.
Oh.
And then there's papal bull, which comes from bulla, which is old Latin meaning blob, as in a wax seal. So five different uses of the word bull or bully, all from different origins.
Ah, we need you on our pub quiz team, Ben. Yeah.
Five different language APIs.
That's true. Do you have to start paying the French when we talk bull?
Or the Dutch?
Or all of them, until we prove which one we mean.
Yeah, it's definitely the cow. The cow.
Yeah, the cow. We'd be paying the Queen then.
Isn't that only swans?
No, the Queen's English.
Okay, my second find. This is a bit old hat, I guess, for a lot of people, but it's controlling music via your phone, so controlling the playback on the PC through your phone. I discovered it in Amarok, but I think you can do it in Clementine and some other music software as well. So it's quite a handy thing if you've got, you know, your music playing on your PC, and just when you're out and, you know, sort of not at your desk, but you're still listening to music through your computer, and just skipping tracks you don't like or finding tracks you do, and just do it with an Android app.
Yeah, Clementine has got an app as well.
Yeah. And my third find is actually, if you find yourself in a situation like Graham did, where you've got your phone and you're trying to get links off another app and it's sort of switching between your browser and that, the Brave browser, which has a lot of features on the desktop like ad blocking and sort of things like that, I reviewed it in the latest issue of Linux Voice. But on the mobile app, it's got this thing where if you click a link, it opens it in the background and you get a little sort of notification thing when it's loaded. And you can do this with several URLs at the same time. And they all load in the background, so you can still use whatever application you were using until the links are fully loaded, and then just switch to the browser.
Ah, cool.
And it's quite handy for following links on mobiles. And those are my finds this fortnight.
Excellent. Have you got anything, Andrew?
Only that Prosecco is dangerous. So if you're at the tills in Asda and you turn around too quickly and accidentally knock a bottle of Prosecco onto the floor, rather than smash harmlessly, because of the pressure in the bottle, it explodes violently upwards, sending shards of sharp glass up your girlfriend's legs. And then you've got to go and sit in A&E with her until 2 a.m. That's it. I was shocked. I was just amazed, really. I mean, all of the sensations such as, you know, sympathy, the urge to comfort, just took second place to, wow, that's amazing. How did that happen?
A proper geek.
That's so cool. Oh, what? Blood. Never
joined us.
Never mind that. So yeah, don't try this at home, kids.
Wow.
Just take my word for it.
Did you have to pay for the bottle of Prosecco, by the way?
No.
Okay.
The Asda staff were very understanding.
I think you should sue Asda for stocking such dangerous hand grenades.
Yeah, why not? Why not? It's all the bloody immigrants' fault anyway.
Yeah, we should start ramping it up, you know, if we care, because there's only a few weeks left until we...
Yeah, it's 4 weeks to keep the pound.
To wrap up this section, you reminded me, Ben, somebody emailed me. I've got a find that I'd like to share. This is from Richard Wienberg. When attending a beer tasting organised by Luvians, a Scottish bottle shop, we were told about DIY Dog, a collection of recipes for all 200-plus beers brewed by BrewDog, probably the best brewer in the UK. I think you might have mentioned this, Ben, a month or two ago, because BrewDog's now worth so much money. Anyway, Rick says, it's really cool that they've open sourced brewing in this way. I remembered that Graham, had written an article about brewing Pi with the Raspberry Pi in the very first edition, so I thought I'd tell you about this in case you'd not heard of it before. I have heard of it, but I haven't looked at any of the recipes and really must do. Maybe, yeah. Good on BrewDog for open sourcing their beer.
Yeah, I always find it a bit interesting that BrewDog do this because they're not, well, I think they are now, but originally they weren't a brewery in the traditional sense of it, as in they didn't have a brewery. They basically rented time in other breweries.
Yeah. They made £600 bottles, didn't they?
Recipes, really.
Sorry, Ben.
Yeah. So all they had was their recipes. That was their entire thing and their branding. And they open sourced it, and it seems to have worked for them.
Hang on. All they had was their recipes and their branding. I think you've hit the nail on the head right there. They've not open sourced their branding, have they? They've not said, go ahead, stick our logo on everything.
Yeah, but it still goes against whatever lots of other people think of as...
Absolutely, yeah. But, I mean, it's the same as, you know, Google isn't a search company, it's an advertising company. BrewDog isn't a brewing company, it's a marketing firm. Not to knock them, you know, they're doing fantastically well at what they do.
Their viral marketing campaign has worked yet again. Right, there are fines.
It's 9:10. Voice of the Masters, a nice quick voice of the Masters here, because the Masters speak with one voice, the voice of the Metatron, as portrayed so memorably by Alan Rickman. So, Debian has stopped support for ye olde 586 class processors in the newer versions of Debian, so that's going to come into effect in 2020. So that's after 25 years of support. In contrast, those non-evil people at Google have not only stopped supporting certain Nest devices, but they've actively bricked them. They've reached out like Daniel Plainview, drinking your milkshake and making your devices not work just because it suits them. They're non-evil taxpayers. So our question is, how long do you think hardware should get software updates? Is 2 years okay for something that you've bought for hundreds of pounds? Is 25 years about right, or should we split the difference and say 13 years and 6 months? Let us know what you think. So I'll kick off with Kevin O'Brien, who says, while it looks like Alphabet, that's Google's parent company now, well, it looks like Alphabet went a bit too far. What is the alternative? Do we seriously want to force developers to maintain support when they don't wish to, for whatever reason? I think a competitive marketplace where you have different options available is the best answer. Anybody else? Anybody want to join in with the competitive marketplace theorem?
Yeah, the thing with that is that you don't. You need to really have that information up front. If you go and buy a product...
Yes, full marks, Mike.
Yes, Mike nails it.
But it should at least then state there, like, we're just going to quit you after 2 years and you can't use your product. That should at least be on the packaging, at least be forced to be put on the packaging.
Yes, a competitive marketplace requires many things, one of which is, an information equilibrium? Where the buyer and the seller both know what they're getting into. Mm-hmm. Which is why the market for second-hand cars so often fails, because the dealer knows what they've got, but the buyer doesn't know what they're buying. Ah. Great.
Is that it?
Well, I think that's it. But let's just get into some more people. So DB Volvox says there's a big difference between ending support, which is what Debian's done, and stopping something from working at all. That's outrageous. Imagine applying that to the software in your car. Several have already advocated going open source, but maybe it should be compulsory. Another round of EU versus Google, our best hope.
What, the EU or Google?
Well, once we've left the EU, of course, we'll be able to pursue Google under our own sovereignty.
That's what's been stopping us.
Well, actually, ironically, the EU could force us to not let Google have the easy tax deal by declaring it an unfair competitive advantage. The EU could actually force a British HMRC to collect all the tax Google owes rather than letting them pay nothing or almost nothing.
But will it straighten our bananas?
Will we take back
bananas? Are about to die out anyway, so it doesn't matter.
Really? I love bananas. Oh no.
There's a massive issue with bananas because they're sterile. They don't get banana seeds. They're always grown from suckers. So
they don't look sterile.
Genetically identical.
But they don't look like they could make babies, do they?
Yeah, it's all those sex ed teachers putting the condoms on them. It means they can't reproduce.
That never happened at my school. Well, we didn't have bananas in the north anyway.
You didn't need it, did you, Mike?
But yeah, on a serious note, there's a disease that's going through the banana populations, and because they can't sexually reproduce, you can't introduce resistance to the disease. They're all genetically identical, and they're all susceptible, and it's entirely plausible that we won't have bananas in the not-too-distant future.
Serious business going on.
That'll make those bureaucrats in Brussels happy. Ray Wood says, my gas boiler is now over 30 years old and still works well. Any replacement would be very expensive, would not last nearly as long, and the energy efficiency would not pay back the replacement costs. If it works, okay. Fulfills its function, then why change? My oldest computer is my Dragon 32, which still works, but most definitely not my go-to computer. If the manufacturers of these old working devices could just pull the plug, I would be very upset. Yeah, well, I mean, what is the rationale for, I mean, ending support? Does that just mean that it's, I mean, they're not going to, Debian developers aren't going to go out and erase all copies of Debian on your old computers, are they?
And to be fair, it's probably better suited to an older distribution or a distribution that caters particularly for older hardware. You know, Debian's moved on. You know, it needs to run systemd, for example.
It's KDE4.
You know, you're just going to have to go and run something else. But like Mike said, as long as the hardware is open, and that's the main thing. If there's enough demand for it, people will make it happen. So I think it's okay. Debian, I suppose, historically has always had a very broad hardware base. So maybe it's the change of something at Debian HQ.
And I think also in Debian's case, it may be that it's just a massive drain to support old architectures. I think it was when they were, maybe they still support the 68K chip, you know, the good old Amiga and Atari ST chips. But they were compiling things for it, like giant office suites and games and stuff, because they were part of the Debian archive, that nobody would ever or could actually play on those machines. So they were producing debs of things like OpenOffice for the Amiga. Nobody was ever going to run, but just because they were in the archive.
Compiling all those German comments.
Exactly, yeah. So, I seem to recall that was a bit of an issue with them. It's like, well, there's three people using this. We're spending $500 a year on electricity compiling all these packages, so chuck it out. And like you say, that Debian is a universal operating system, but it's still got to be pragmatic to a certain extent. If somebody wants to make an OS that keeps running on a 486, although I think that's been dropped by the kernel, but yeah, fair enough.
So on a similar note, here's PyPy, who says, as far as I'm aware, the last boxes with an i586 class processor were produced around 2006. Debian's support for i586 processors always seemed a bit ludicrous to me, mostly because most boxes from the original era probably have insufficient RAM to run Debian at all, let alone well. There are better alternatives for hardware that old. I believe that Alpine Linux still supports i586 hardware and should have a much lighter profile. I wonder if that means, should say, have a much higher profile or a much lighter profile on the RAM banks. I don't know. And Peter, coming back to Mike's winning point, says, let the manufacturers choose themselves how long to support devices, but force them to make it clear to the buyer before they buy the product. At the end of the checkout line, there should be a capture making sure the buyer knows the expiration date. If the buyer gets it wrong, they can't buy the product.
That is the solution to capitalism. Yeah. That's the solution to people knowing what they're getting into. Problem solved, thanks to Linux Voice.
Excellent. Yeah, I quite like the idea of having an expiration date on hardware. A best before.
Yeah.
I don't like it. Stuff should keep working, but I like the...
But then you'd create...
You have to see it.
you'd create a market for stuff that wasn't so whiz-bang but was guaranteed to last longer.
Yeah, and if it's open source, you could always have an expiry date that is forever.
Yeah. It's the old information thing, malarkey. Duncan Murray says, the Linux kernel can't be all things to all men and women. Even Linus thinks that we'd benefit from another much smaller kernel, as long as we leave a little note to say which version of Debian was the last to support the early Pentium processors, then people who are using that hardware can still use and possibly even maintain it. Right. Yeah. This is all... Oh, here's a good one. Phil Thane... I should add, they're all good ones, obviously. Phil Thane says, a for-profit corporation will provide just as much support as it feels it must to avoid upsetting too many users. I guess a few thousand early adopters being upset doesn't really bother Google when they're aiming to sell the Internet of Things to billions of people. Debian is probably about right for a community project, though I can see problems if it works through to the derivatives. My quad-core homebrew desktop, built from not especially ancient parts about 2 years ago, won't run 64-bit versions of Ubuntu or Mint. It seems to be a graphics chipset problem, but rather than figure it out, I just run the 32-bit version. Oh well.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Frank, let's end with Frank. Frank says, I suspect that the percentage of 486 and 586 machines that remains functional is very small. Stuff wears out, it happens. My last Pentium 3 died about 4 years ago. I do have a 686 class machine that is currently running 32-bit Mageia.
Excellent. Well, that was good.
Yeah. I love the idea of a capture at the checkout. And you know, companies being made to explicitly declare how long stuff will last for.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think looking at the camera view of Andrew, where it's got very dark in his room, he looks a little bit like Colonel Kurtz at the end of the river.
I feel just like Colonel Kurtz.
I think we should all call it an evening at this point.
If I just hold up some courgette plants in front of my face. There we go.
So thanks everyone for contributing. Thanks for all the finds. Thanks for all of the Voices of the Massive's contributions. And hopefully, with a bit of luck, although Ben won't be here, and Ben in fact has just disappeared off Hangouts, we'll be back in 2 weeks' time.
Great stuff.
Thanks everybody.
Bye.
Take care.
Bye.
Servus. Bye-bye.